got a Bible, turn with me to Judges chapter 1. We're just 1 week in, so if you missed last week, you're going to be okay. We're not so far in that you're going to be lost. In fact, we'll sort of backtrack a little bit just to make sure we're kind of all on the same page here as we start. But last fall, I was passing through Calgary, and I stopped at IKEA. Now, I have a love-hate relationship with IKEA. Most of you will be able to relate. I don't like the feeling that I get when I go in. I think it's probably how most feels when they put it into those mazes, because you know that? It's like you need the map to get out, and it's like the smart people can figure out the shortcuts. The rest of us are wandering for hours through this building. But I needed blinds, so I... Now, here's the... You're going to see where the problem comes very quickly. I was on my own. Linda was not there with me. Now, I did have her cell phone, and I think I called home like 3 or 4 times over the course of half an hour in the blind section. So it's this section that's probably twice the size, maybe 3 times the size of the stage, with all the colors of the blinds that you could possibly imagine, except for the color that I thought I wanted, which was the first problem. And then there's the measurements, and then there's how much do you want to be able to see through the blind, and then do you want it to do this or pull down? Anyway, I finally got to the moment where I selected my blinds, I bought my blinds, I brought my blinds home, I set them in a room knowing that in a few months' time I would need them. That moment came 2 weeks ago as I took the first blind out of the package. The room was all painted and ready for window coverings, and I installed the first blind. Now, in the package came this little booklet, the instruction manual. And it's interesting, I didn't realize this, that now with IKEA products, there's actually no words at all. So you don't have to worry about the language issue anymore. Now there's just helpful little diagrams. Perfect. So I open up my helpful little diagram book. And now there's only like 6 pieces in the box. So I was in pretty good shape, feeling fairly confident at the start. I had to supply my own screws. That was interesting. So I knew as I was starting to get a little nervous what screws to use and all these kind of things. And then I got the blind up. It looked good. It fit. I stepped back. It's like, this is success. And then I went, and I don't even think I pulled it down. I think I went to get Linda, and I need a lot of affirmation. I'm like, look at what I've done, right? So she comes and pulled the blind down, and it went back up. Pulled the blind down, went back up. I'm like, I mean, I'm looking at this thing, and there's only so many parts that I could have messed up on, and I don't think I did. And so I remember thinking, it's like, I gotta take this back to IKEA in Calgary. I got a deficient. What are the odds that I got a deficient blind from IKEA? Now, I let some time go by because I wasn't going to rush back to Calgary just for the sake of one blind. And I had these 2 other blinds. And so I thought, I will install the other 2 smaller blinds. And I did those just last week. I got them up. Same instructions, same blinds, same mounting, pulled them down, they went back up. I'm like, I got the 3 faulty IKEA blinds. And then I picked up the little instruction book. Now, I had looked at the instruction. I got halfway through the instruction book before I realized, you know what? You got to be an idiot to need this instruction book. But halfway through, there's a little picture of a guy, kind of hard at first to figure out what he's doing, what the hands are doing. By the way, I was almost ready to drive a nail through the wall and make like a hook into the blind to keep it down. And then you realize you pull it down, and then you just give it a little pull and then a little release, and you let go, and it works. Amazing. I'm not sure how it works. I don't understand the mechanism of why that worked, and 100 other things I tried didn't work, and the thought went through my head, you idiot, you did not follow the instructions. I followed half of them. But you know, following half the instructions isn't following the instructions. Following half the instructions means you actually failed to follow half of the instructions. And you know, in the spiritual faith realm of life, being half obedient means we're half disobedient. Half following Jesus means we're half not following Jesus. And you start to realize there are some serious things going on when we do things halfway. And really, in some ways, the story of Judges is people doing things halfway. They half followed, they half listened, they half obeyed. And we're going to see this morning as we work through Judges chapter 1 and into chapter 2, God's assessment on what going halfway actually is all about. But that's our plan for today. We're going to try to get from chapter 1 verse 18 to chapter 2 verse 5. The quick summary, so we're all on the same page, goes something like this. God made everything, it was very good. Mankind chose to sin and rebel and put himself in the place of God. That was very bad. God judged it. There was death and sin and brokenness by Genesis chapter 3. God, in his amazing compassion and mercy, didn't just say, I'm done. Earth, stars, solar system, be gone. Instead, he showed new grace. And by chapter 3 through 11 of Genesis, we have a very kind of interesting little repeated cycle. It gets repeated, I think, four times. The cycle is this. God shows grace, humans sin, God judges, and then there's new grace. So if you think through the story of Cain and Abel, it's got that plot line. Think through the story of Noah, it's got the plot line. Think through the story of the Tower of Babel, and we run into a problem. Because God has shown new grace, then man sins, then God judges, and you get to the end of Genesis chapter 11, and here's the million-dollar question. Will God show grace again? In fact, Genesis chapter 11 ends without any answer to that problem. In some ways, the rest of Scripture is the answer. It's going to take the rest of Scripture for us to see God's response of new grace to the brokenness that we see in Genesis 1 to 11. And God's answer, his new grace, is going to come in the form of a promise made to a man named Abraham, who God picks out, not because of Abraham's greatness or obedience or stellar moral character, nothing. God just says, I'm just going to pick you, but Abraham, through you, I'm going to bless the nations. I'm going to give you offspring that number as many as the stars, the sky. I'm going to give you a great name, you'll be known, and I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to put you into a specific place that the rest of the world will be able to see what it means to follow me. Abraham has a son named Isaac. That promise is passed on. Isaac has a son named Jacob, whose name eventually is changed to Israel, who has two sons through whom that promise is passed on. That family ends up in Egypt because one son goes there whose name is Joseph, through whom this promise is passed on. The family ends up as slaves in Egypt, and 430 years of hard, brutal slavery will go by before God finally spares and delivers his people. That takes us to the book of Exodus. And through the next 40 years, God's people wander in the wilderness, which takes us all the way to the book of Joshua. And for about the next 5 years, give or take, the people of Israel, these offspring of these men, this family, begin to settle the land that God had promised, doing two things. One, receiving the land God had given, and two, bringing about the judgment on the peoples who had lived there that God had also promised he would bring. Six specific people groups that God had named all the way back in Genesis, but clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 20, where God says, their sin has reached a maximum. I'm going to take no more. It took 400 years to get there, but now the moment has come of my judgment. And we arrive at the point of Judges chapter 1, of Joshua just having died at age of 110, of no leader seemingly in his place, but this family now becoming a great nation, beginning to settle and conquer the land that God had promised to them. And last week we saw the opening stages of this book as a part of the family, one branch of the family, the tribe of Judah, has gone up, commanded by God, to begin to take control of the land, to wage war on God's behalf, to finally claim the land God had promised to them hundreds of years earlier. And last week, as we walked through those opening verses, we wrestled with this strange dilemma. Is what we're reading an account of the obedience of the nation of Israel, or is it disobedience? Because it's a mixed bag. In fact, it almost seems like in every verse, there's a part of what we're reading that sounds right and good, and a part of what we're reading that sounds broken and sinful. And we're left sorting out as the readers, is this action to be commended and imitated? Or is this sin that we're watching on display? We're going to jump in verse 18, and we'll pick up with the exact same theme. In fact, that's going to be the message really through the rest of chapter 1 before we come to chapter 2. Verse 18, Judah, we're still with Judah at this point. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory and Ashkelon with its territory and Ekron with its territory. Again, one of these moments where we say, this sounds good. It sounds like they're actually obeying what God had commanded them to do. This was not optional. This was God's command. You must do this. Go and take the land, and Judah, you're first. So we've got a verse of obedience. And then the very next verse goes like this. And the Lord, verse 19, was with Judah. Again, that sounds good. God's with you. I mean, all of us want God with us. The Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country. But he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. And all of a sudden, we're right back to this strange dichotomy. God was with them, and so they had victory. But one sentence later, the very thing that they're called to do, the very thing God promised to do, the very thing that God had already done. I mean, you go back to Joshua, we've already read an account in Joshua. These people would have remembered it. Some of them might have lived through it, where God had his people go and fight a superior enemy with chariots, and God worked in supernatural ways to deliver his people. God could do it, had instructed them to do it. In my Judges chapter 1, verse 19, they didn't do the very thing God had told them they must do. Are they obeying? Are they sinning? Is God with them? Is God opposed to them? Are they carrying out the mandate that God instructed to them? In part, but not fully. What are we to make of this situation? Verse 20. And Hebron was given to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he drove out from it the three sons of Anak. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. Two problems with that verse. Firstly, if you go back to verse 8, you discover that the tribe of Judah had already driven out the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And it seems like in verse 8, they had totally destroyed the city. And yet by verse 21, there's people living there who are Canaanites, and we're left saying, again, what are we to do with this? Is Scripture just making mistakes? The answer is no. Are God's people being fully obedient? The answer is no. Are they being fully disobedient? Doesn't seem to be. They are waging war. They are going into the land. But what do you do with this mess that we're reading of? The second thing we should note in that verse 21 is that for the first time, we have this little statement that someone lived with someone else. All right, just pay attention to that one through the rest of chapter 1. When we read Judah's account, there was no statement of Judah living with anyone. Judah goes in, takes the land, and they're there. By the time we come to this little statement about the next tribe, Benjamin, we find out that the Jebusites, a part of these Canaanites who they're to destroy and expel from the land, are now living with the tribe of Benjamin. They're not supposed to be there. The instruction was really painfully clear, awkwardly clear even. The Canaanites are to be no more. And yet, the Canaanites are now living with the very people of God who it seems like a verse before God is with. You start to get the sense of a problem growing here. The problem doesn't get any better. By verse 22, we kind of come to our second major part of chapter 1. So the first major part is Judah going up. That's kind of the language. Judah goes up to fight on behalf of the Lord and to take part of the land. Now, verse 22, the house of Joseph, you see the language, also went up. This time against Bethel. So Judah goes and fights the first major city, Jerusalem. Now Joseph is going to go up and fight another major city. We're talking about, I think it's about 15 miles, 30 kilometers, something like that away, Bethel. And the Lord was with them. Again, now we have one of these statements where it sounds good. Judah's gone up, but the Lord was with Judah, and they had victory. Now Joseph's going to go up, and the Lord is with him. So let me ask you, what do you expect? We should have victory. That's the plot. That's the structure to the book. You're being set up so that as a reader, we read this and say, I know what's going to happen next. I know what verse 23 should tell me. Verse 23 should just simply be a statement that the tribe of Joseph had victory over Bethel because God was with them. Instead, here's what we read. The house of Joseph scouted out Bethel. Now the name of the city was formerly Luz. The spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, please show us the way into the city, and we will deal kindly with you. And he showed them the way into the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go, and the man went to the land of the Hittites and built a city and called its name Luz. That is its name to this day. Kind of a victory. Not the same kind of victory that Judah won. The Lord is with Judah. Judah went up. Judah won. The Lord is with Joseph. Joseph went up. And he sent out spies and makes a treaty, lets a Canaanite go so he can rebuild his city, and kind of, sort of, almost partially wins a victory of sorts. You start to see the problem of what Judges chapter 1 is presenting to us. Now, one of the things I did in the early service, and I'll do it real quickly here, just so you kind of know if you're in a small group with someone for the early service, what they're talking about. I was trying to show briefly something that's very common in the book of Judges. That is, the Judges is going to say things with words. Words are important. But Judges is also going to say things with structure, how the words are put together. Just like what I showed you there of Judah goes up because the Lord's with him and wins victory, and Joseph goes up because the Lord's with him and we expect victory. You see how there's kind of a parallel? And we're shocked that Joseph doesn't win the same kind of victory that Judah wins because everything else seems the same. Something's going on here from verse 22 to 26 that I think would have been obvious to anyone who had read this, who knew the story of Joshua particularly, and probably if you were a Jewish person for all time eternity, you read verse 22 to 26, you said, oh wow, I've seen this story before. This is the story of Jericho. The parallels are stunning, and yet not. Let me explain. If we were to kind of do that, I apologize. This is small, I know. It's just sort of to help you kind of picture it, not so you can read it. So if you can't read it from the back, don't panic. You'll get the point. On the one hand, we have the city of Bethel. The other, we have Jericho. Just kind of follow along the parallels in the two stories. I wrote them up so I don't mess up. Number one, in both situations, we get sort of spies going out to kind of do reconnaissance, right? So we start with spies. Joshua sends them out. Tribe of Joseph sends them out. Then the next thing is they encounter a Canaanite person in both situations. So there's a Canaanite. Over here, it's a woman. She's a harlot. She's seemingly a prostitute from Jericho. Her name's Rahab. Over here, we're never given the man's name. He's just a man who lives in this town called Bethel, right? So you see the parallels happening here. Then what happens in both stories over here, they form, actually I'm going to write this bigger. I'll do it like this big. They form a hesed. There's your $1 million word. You can go show off this afternoon to all your friends. I learned a word in church today. It's the word used to describe the loyal love God has for his people. It's a covenant word. When that word shows up, it's usually the essence, the idea, the sense of it is that God is forming an agreement with people that he is going to commit himself to and will never, ever, ever break. And it's a word that in English sometimes we translate as loving kindness or covenant loyalty, because it's hard to find one word in English that fully gets the whole sense of this, of God's firm commitment, a loving, merciful commitment to do something. The people of Israel form this commitment with this woman. By the time we get to Judges, we find the people of Israel forming that commitment with that man. You start to see the parallels. They're the same story. Different cities, different people, but it's the same story. Here's the problem over here. By this point, God has says, when you go into the land, there's only two things I require of you. Number one, do not form a covenant with anyone. You go read the language all through Deuteronomy and Numbers. God says, when you get to the land, here's the things. Two things. Remember these two things. Don't form a covenant. Second, destroy all the altars. Like if you do nothing else, don't fail in those two things. What do? They form a covenant with this man. The one thing they're not supposed to do. Now, the stories continue. In this case, Rahab, our Canaanite woman, she, the harlot, she helps the Israelites in their attempt to take Jericho. In this case, the Canaanite man, he helps the Israelites in their attempt to take Bethel. Here's where things get a little bit different. In this story, Yahweh, the Lord, he wins a great victory, doesn't he? He's really not helped all that much by anyone. They march around Jericho. You remember the story? Around and around and around. God works. Victory happens. The Canaanite woman plays a very minor role in the victory. But all of a sudden in this story, you notice the missing character? The Lord's gone. We don't read in there that the Lord did something supernatural or miraculous. They waged war, they found a way in, and the people helped by a Canaanite take the place of God. God sort of disappears from the scene. Back to this story, this woman then becomes a part of Israel. She becomes a part of the covenant people of God. And we would expect in this story, this Canaanite man to look and say, wow, look what the Lord has done. You have captured this city. I want to be a part of the people of God. Isn't that how we would expect the story to play out? Instead, what does he say? Well, we don't read this. He says, hey, would it be all right if I go and just build myself another city? Just kind of call it the same thing it used to be called, and I'll just carry on being the kind of person I used to be. I'll just continue to be a Hittite. And the Israelites say, sure, I guess there's no problem with that. He goes and he builds another Hittite city. I mean, the Israelites are supposed to go into the land to get rid of the Hittites, and now all they've done is just kind of relocated them down the street. And then the most shocking moment of all. When you get to the end of this story in Joshua chapter 6, it's told in chapter 2 and chapter 6, and between those two chapters, Israel is reminded of the covenant they formed with God at Gilgal. You get to the end, and we have this incredible statement. Yahweh, the Lord, was with them. That's how the story ends. The Lord is with them. Here's the problem. In this story, we start out there. You look at verse 22. The Lord was with them. And the end? We're left to wonder, where is he? Is he there? Has the disobedience of this people through this, where they should have looked and said, you know what? Wow, this sure reminds us of that time when God worked in amazing ways in Jericho. Maybe we should trust him in a similar way. But they didn't. And we get to the end, and here's the staggering question. Is it possible that they have lost fellowship with the Lord? All right, make sure you pay attention to the structure as you work through the book. All sorts of interesting stuff happening there. Through the next number of verses, from verse 27 to the end, we have a long list of the various tribes and their failures to take the land that they were supposed to take, that Joshua had spelled out from Joshua chapter 13 to 19. It's very particular. This tribe gets this area, this tribe gets this area. So we would expect Judges chapter 1 to be just a description of, they go in and they take the land. They go in and they take the land. They go in and they take the land. And instead we read things like this. Verse 27, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, Asher did not drive out the inhabitants. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants in verse 33. You get the picture of what's happening? We start out with Judah. Remember I mentioned the whole living little word? You get Judah, no statement that anyone's living with him. Judah goes into the land. Judah seems to get rid of the Canaanites. He does the job. Benjamin goes into the land, and what happens? All of a sudden, the Canaanites are living with Benjamin. By the time we get a little bit further into this story, it's no longer the Canaanites living with the Israelites. By the time we get to verse 33, it's the Israelites living with the Canaanites. And by the time we get to the end, by verse 35 and 36, we're confused by this point of who's even living with who. It's not really clear. The English maybe makes it seem clearer than it really is. We get to the end of the story and we're left saying, whose land even is this? The only description we get is a strange little comment about a border in verse 36. That unless you know somehow your ancient geography way better than I do, it's probably fairly meaningless, but let me give you a little tip. The cities that you're reading about right there in verse 36 are not on the outskirts of Israel. This isn't where you would expect to find an Amorite border. It is right in the heartland of the promised land. We get to the end of chapter 1. We step back and we go, what's gone wrong? Whose land is this? This is the land promised by God to these people that they were to take. They haven't taken it. We get these interesting little insights all the way through, and I'll just mention three or four of them quickly before we jump into chapter 2. The place names start to take on some pretty important significance. By verse 29, we find out that Ephraim specifically did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, which is one of the cities chosen by God to be a place where the Levites, the people who will lead the nation in worship, that's to be one of their cities. And what happens? They have no place. You start to get this sense that something's gone wrong. That if the priesthood who's to lead the nation of Israel in worship doesn't even have a place, what will happen to this nation as the story unfolds in the coming chapter? By verse 33, Naphtali didn't drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth-Anath. Those place names, those aren't just insignificant place names. Those names actually have meaning. There means the house of or temple of. And then we're reading the names of Canaanite gods and goddesses. They failed to drive out the inhabitants of these places. Instead, what did they do? They said, well, we could never live there, obviously. These are the center points of Canaanite false religion. So maybe we failed. So I guess we'll just have to go live somewhere else. And that's not what you read, was it? They didn't succeed in driving the people out. And what did they do? I guess we'll just live with them. Beth Shemesh, that's the center place for worship of the Egyptian god of the sun. The very people who have oppressed them for 430 years, Egypt had a center of worship of their god, and the Israelites are living there, seemingly without any particular issue, without any particular struggle. By the time we get to verse 35, the Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres, in Ajalon. Well, does that mean anything? Kind of. Because that's the precise spot where Joshua once went to battle. It's the center of, again, the worship of the sun. That place, the language, the whole culture of that geographic spot was worshiping the sun god. And when Joshua showed up there and won a great victory, that's the spot where God stopped the sun moving. I love that story. When you know that background, it's like God saying, you know what, Canaanites, Egyptians, you might think your sun god is stronger than me. Watch this. And he stops the sun in a miraculous intervention. And now just a few short years later, the Israelites are going to live among the Canaanites in a center of worship of a false god. What do we do with chapter 1? Well, here's the irony. We're not told in chapter 1. There's no narrative comments. There's no moment in chapter 1 where it says, Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, or something like that, where we would get a clarity. What do we do with this situation? It's not until chapter 2 where we get our clarity. Let's look quickly here. Verse 1. Now the angel of the Lord, or messenger of the Lord, we're not sure exactly the nature of this messenger yet. That's going to become clearer further on. Went up from Gilgal to Bochim, the place of weeping. Now, why Gilgal? Well, that's the place where Israel formed the covenant. It's not that angels live at Gilgal, and that's where they have to travel from. There's a significance to the description. Here's this angel coming from the very place where Joshua had been, and the nation of Israel had pledged themselves in a covenant to the Lord. It's the place where they set up a monument of stone saying, we remember right here we formed a covenant, and we pledged that we would never break it. God sends a messenger from Gilgal. And the messenger comes, and here's what the messenger says. I brought you up out of Egypt, brought you to the land I swore to give to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land, and you shall break down their altars. Again, what are the two things that God was pretty insistent on? Numbers, Deuteronomy, there they are, right again. No covenants, break down altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say I will not drive them out before you. They will become thorns in your side. Their God shall be a snare to you. God comes, and now he brings clarity to chapter 1. What was chapter 1 all about? What were you reading? You were reading a record of the disobedience of the nation of Israel. See, half obedience in the eyes of God is actually not obedience at all. half following is not following at all. And it's shocking in some ways that God didn't come along with sort of a mixed message and said, well, you know, you did some good things, but then I have some things against you. Kind of like a message to one of the churches in Revelation. Instead, we just get this very clear, concise message. You didn't obey. I just asked some simple things of you, and you have failed. Now, be really careful with what you do with verse 3. The one that says, so now I say. It sounds like God said, here's the covenant, and I was going to bless you, but you failed, and so now I'm changing the rules. That's not what's going on. That language is actually better translated. It would be much more fitting if we translated it something like this. And God also said, because it's not that he's added a new message. Go back to Numbers chapter 33. It's exactly what he said he would do. This is his covenant. He said, here's the covenant I'm going to make, and I will keep it. If you obey, I'm going to bless you. If you disobey, there's going to be consequence. They knew it going in. They knew the simple, you know, simple steps of obedience required. They knew the consequence if they failed. And God's simply saying, I will keep my covenant. Where does that leave us? Let me try to bring some application to this morning. I think at a bare minimum, we need to think long and hard about our own obedience. Don't take this as a message and say, you know what, well, it's funny you mention it because I know someone who's only half obedient. Right? They show up at some stuff, but man, if you saw their lives, whew. Or I know someone who only kind of follows Jesus half-hearted. You know, do you want me to come and tell you that person afterwards and then you, pastor, you can deal with them? No. What I think we're supposed to do with passages like this is not use them as a measuring stick for other people. It's to examine our own lives. That's the continual message of Scripture. Don't go hunting for other people who you can condemn. Look at your own heart. Now, here's the specific I think we ought to look at long and hard. Yes, there's actions, and we're a mixed bag. In fact, one of the most common questions I run into in the counseling situation, this is a bonus, this is free. You have people who come with, you know, a situation, and they give an account of a person in their lives, and they've done some good things and some bad things, and they go like, what do I do with this? Like, is the person good or bad? I get asked essentially that question a lot of the time. Are they good or bad? Right? Because they've sinned, but they've also done some, you know, like a husband or wife or kids, like what do we do with this? And I find it a funny question because it's a question that we never ask of ourselves. You notice how we do that? We look at ourselves and we know we're a mixed bag. I sometimes mess up. Sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I mess up. And I don't look and go, well, I've got to be one or the other. Either I'm good or I'm bad. Which am I? And clearly the good part must be the act. And so then we must conclude that I am a terrible person. Right? It's a fun conversation to have in an office. The reality is, we're kind of a mixed bag, aren't we? Some days my trust and faith in the Lord is huge. I feel like I could take on the world. And sometimes just a few hours later, I look and go, why am I so weak? And I don't look and go, well, I'm a mixed bag, so the good part must have been an act and I was pretending. And the real, no, I give myself all sorts of grace in that. So make sure you give people grace. But what do we do as we kind of consider this message of obedience? In 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter directs Christians just like us who are followers of Jesus on how he wants them to live. And he gets to verse 5 and he says to them, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, self-control with steadfastness, steadfastness with godliness, godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. Now there's a pretty good list of, boy, if we could do some things in following Jesus, what a great list. Knowledge and virtue and steadfastness and godliness and brotherly affection and love. Don't stop halfway with the list. That's what I'm going to implore you. I think that's what we're inclined to do. See, some of us are great at the knowledge side and we get truth down cold and we know it. And we go, well, at least I've got half of it. Doing pretty good. Brotherly affection and love. That's full obedience. And others are great at the love part that ooze. Oh, and we all love those people, right? Let's be honest. We love the people who want to love us. Don't stop halfway. Grab hold of truth. Grab hold of both sides of that. Now, how do we do it? Peter goes on in the next couple of verses. Whoever lacks these qualities, verse 9, is nearsighted, he's blind. Having forgotten, he was cleansed from his former sin. Peter says, there's the problem. The problem's a remembering problem. And isn't it interesting in Judges chapter 2, when the messenger comes and says, here's what's happened. You need to remember that the Lord brought you out of Egypt. The Lord made a covenant. It's a remembering answer, saying it seems like you have forgotten some things, and the forgetting of these things has led you into sin. And I think maybe the same thing is true in my heart. It's when I start forgetting some things that I'm inclined to start following halfway or obeying halfway. Jerry Bridges, who's, I think, a great Bible teacher. No one's perfect, but I like his stuff. He, at the age of 75, which isn't that old, be careful of this one, he's quite young. He wrote, and he was asked kind of how to finish well. Here's what he wrote. Over the last few years, I've given a lot of thought to how to finish well. A number of things could be said, but I've come to the conclusion there are four fundamental actions we need to take to finish well. Here they are. Number one, a daily time focused on communion with God. You want to fully obey? You want to fully follow? There's no shortcut. Daily time in God's Word where you're communing with Him. Number two, daily appropriation of the gospel. Not just that the gospel's for lost people out there and we need to share the news. The gospel is for this person right here. When Paul says to the Galatians in chapter 2, you know, daily, it's like every day I dwell in the gospel that Jesus Christ gave himself for me. That's not just for people out there. He says, that's how I live. Because every day we wrestle. Every day we fall. Every day we need to get back up. And the gospel is the answer to that. Third, a daily commitment to God as a living sacrifice. Every day waking up and saying, Lord, I'm yours. Yet again today. Romans 12, that's that Romans 12 language. A continual, ever-present realization that I've been purchased, I'm bought. So my life is now a daily, continual, living sacrifice to the Lord. Number four, a firm belief in the sovereignty and love of God. Because life is difficult. And if you lose your grip on the sovereign, loving God, the difficulties aren't going to make sense. A firm belief in the sovereign love of God. As we come to an end, though, let me just point you to hope. You see, there's a problem in Judges chapter 2. Again, it's one of those ones that doesn't seem to quite show up the way it ought to in my English version. It's a question in right at the end of verse 2. And my translation puts it this way, what is this you have done? That's not very accurate. I think a way better way to put it would be something like this. What am I supposed to do next? Here's the problem of the covenant. God says, I will bless you. I'm going to keep it. There's never a doubt. But I'm not going to bless disobedient people. It's not going to happen. I will bless you. I'm not going to bless disobedient people. Judges 1, what have we got? God's people disobeying. And God poses the question, what will I do next? How do I keep these things when you won't obey? Let me tell you the answer quickly. The answer is going to be Jesus. The answer is going to be that it will cost God his life to do that. To be able to bless a people, but not bless a disobedient people. See, we're not going to be able to clean up or act enough that one day we qualify as obedient people and God says, oh, finally, I finally found a few good men and women that I can bless. Instead, he says in Jeremiah 31, I'm going to have to do something new. Not like the old covenant. I haven't failed in my part, but no one's been able to keep their part. So now I will do it all. I'll send my one and only son. And he will die in your place, fulfilling perfectly my justice, living perfectly in obedience, and offering the whole thing as a gift, not earned, not a moment of it earned, because we would fail utterly. No one would qualify. Instead, the whole thing just being a gift where God says, you know what? Here's a new covenant. A new covenant I've sealed in the blood of my son. A covenant, same word, this one, that I will keep if you just receive it as a gift. Isn't that great news, Emmanuel? We have that kind of covenant.